This is Audible.
Podium Publishing presents Paradise, Book 3 of Expeditionary Force, written by Craig Allenson, performed by R.C. Bray. Prologue. 3 months after the original merry band of pirates left Paradise. U.S. Army Specialist Jesse Cornpone Coulter took a freshly cleaned pair of white cotton gloves out of a box, put them on, and adjusted the surgical face mask to completely cover his nose and mouth. Checking himself in a small mirror attached to a tree, he took a deep breath, reached down into the pen, and carefully, very carefully, picked up a small, yellow, fluffy thing. It was a chick. A baby chicken. On Paradise. A small miracle. Or, the chick was small. The miracle was great. Jesse held the chick up to eye level, inspecting its feet. Everything looked fine, or it looked fine as much as Jesse knew about chickens. A month ago, what he knew about chickens was that they tasted good and produced eggs. Also, that they weren't bred to be smart. Smart, ha, he thought, as he set the chick back down in the clean straw of the pen. The chick had been brought to Paradise as a fertilized egg. Jesse had volunteered to fight in space against the enemies of humanity. Only their allies turned out to be the real enemy, and the enemy was a species that mostly wanted to ignore humans. Between him and the chicken, he asked himself, who was the dumb one? The presence of Earth animals on Paradise had been UNEF's most closely guarded secret. The last 3 Kristang ships to bring supplies from Earth had included chicken eggs, baby calves, baby pigs, and baby goats. Not all of the young animals survived the long trip, and since the Ruhar fleet had firmly reestablished its hold on Paradise, no more animals would be coming from Earth. UNEF HQ had kept the presence of these animals a secret for 2 reasons. Until the survival of a significant population of Earth animals on Paradise could be established, UNEF didn't want to get people's hopes up that they might someday have fresh food other than fruits and vegetables. And perhaps equally important was that the presence of domesticated Earth animals on Paradise would signal that the expeditionary force would not be returning home for a long time. A very long time. That was even before the Ruhar took back Paradise and cut off UNEF's only possibility of going home. That fateful day when the Ruhar fleet took Paradise back from the Kristang was more than 3 months gone by now. The first couple weeks had been chaotic. UNEF HQ quickly had ordered human forces across the planet to lay down their weapons, recognizing that rifles against starships was not a survivable fight for UNEF. Not all humans had complied with the surrender order. These people had come out to the stars to fight hamsters, and they couldn't mentally adapt to their changed situation. The fact is, there were hard feelings on both sides, and those feelings weren't going away in a month, or a year, or maybe even a generation. After 2 or 3 weeks, the situation stabilized, and humans accepted that the renewed Ruhar presence in the sky wasn't merely another raid. Those humans who still insisted on fighting the Ruhar occupiers were dealt with by the Ruhar military, in some cases harshly, and sometimes with a level of force wildly disproportionate to the threat. No one needed an orbital railgun strike to deal with 3 humans hiding out in the bush, but with the Ruhar completely in charge, there was no one to appeal to for de-escalating the use of force. And hearing that the Ruhar had used a railgun against 3 guys who had limited ammo, almost no food, and posed no real threat, was a powerful message to the rest of UNEF. The message was heard loud and clear by all humans on Paradise. The Ruhar controlled the high ground. Do not mess with them. Rumors were flying fast via the informal Z-phone network. The Kristang fleet was gathering outside the Paradise system and would soon take back the planet. No, the Kristang had given up on Paradise. The raids were only a way to harass and distract the Ruhar. The Ruhar were negotiating to send humans back to Earth. No, humans were never going back to Earth. Humans were being recruited to fight with the Ruhar? No, the advanced Ruhar had no interest in working with weak, primitive human soldiers. Whatever you feared or wanted to believe, there was a rumor out there tailor-made for you. Jesse didn't believe any of the rumors, other than that they were rumors. He believed what he knew, what he'd seen. 5 weeks after the Ruhar took back the planet, Jesse and his fireteam buddy Dave Ski Chaika had volunteered to move from a makeshift POW camp to a new UNEF farm on the southern continent of Paradise. The farm was informally being called Fort Rakovsky after a U.S. Army soldier who had died in the first Ruhar raid. Rumor had it, and this rumor Jesse thought might be true, that most humans would eventually be scattered in settlements across the southern continent that humans called Lemuria. That would keep them away from the bulk of the Ruhar civilian population, and isolated groups of humans would be easier and cheaper to control. Jesse didn't need rumors to tell him that UNEF was never going home. The Ruhar were planning for humans to stay on Paradise long-term. Rumors were nothing but uninformed BS nonsense. The Ruhar knew the truth. The fact that the Ruhar were making the effort to help UNEF set up farming villages meant that the Ruhar knew their unwanted human guests were on Paradise to stay. Stay for a very long time. Or permanently. One thing he knew for certain was that chickens taste good, Jesse told himself as he carefully reached into another section of the pen to pick up another precious chick. Each chick had its own section of the pen. They were far too valuable to risk young chickens damaging each other in fights. When the chicks grew old enough, they would be removed from the pens to roam free in a fenced field. 10 chickens to a field. 10 chickens was a number large enough for the chickens not to feel isolated from each other, and few enough for an assigned group of soldiers to manage and protect. Although the native life on Paradise could not digest anything from Earth, that did not mean the native predators were not interested in killing what appeared to them to be tempting targets. Because most humans were not allowed by the Ruhar to have any weapons that could threaten the Ruhar, Jesse and the other chicken herders had to fend off predators with sharpened sticks. Fortunately, in his area of Lemuria, the largest predator was about the size of a fox on Earth. Jesse had only seen one of the fox-like animals once, and it had run back into the jungle when he had shouted and waved his spear at it. No chicken was going to be lost to a native predator at Fort Rakovsky. Not on Jesse's watch. The most dangerous predators on Paradise were not native to the planet, and they walked on 2 legs. There were plenty of humans who would find it difficult to resist the temptation of a delicious, frying-sized chicken walking around. Despite the threat of severe penalties from UNEF, there had been incidents of chickens, pigs, and goats being killed and cooked up for a feast. Eating animals was strictly banned by UNEF. An animal on a plate could not create more animals, and the population of domesticated Earth animals was still too small to consider using them as a food source yet. Also, the Ruhar considered eating animals to be a barbaric practice that civilized, sentient beings would not do. As prisoners of war existing on the kindness of the Ruhar, UNEF could not afford to insult their hosts. So there would not be anyone eating animals, despite all the time, expense, and effort expended to bring domesticated food animals to Paradise. Chickens were used to produce eggs, which could be eaten. More accurately, chicken eggs would be regularly eaten someday when there were enough chickens. That might happen within a year, perhaps longer. Cows and goats could be used to provide milk, milk that was supposed to be available soon. Pigs were a problem. While Jesse had heard the old joke that you could use every part of a pig except for its squeal, the Ruhar didn't allow any part of a pig to be used. UNEF was stuck raising and feeding pigs without being able to get any benefit from the effort, and pigs consumed a lot of food that was needed by humans. Pigs would not be allowed to breed. Once the current population aged and died, there would be no more pigs on Paradise. "Hey, Ski," Jesse asked, "what about this one?" Dave Ski Chaika set down the chick he had been handling and walked over to look at the one Jesse was holding up. "That's normal, I think," he announced, looking at one slightly bent toe on the chick's left foot. "Don't worry about it." "Y'all sure about that?" Jesse was worried about all the chicks he was responsible for. "It don't look right." "Yeah," Ski said reassuringly. "Come on, man, it's a chicken. All it needs to do is walk around, eat grain, and lay eggs." "Have you say so." Jesse set the chick back down in its straw bed, unconvinced. Ski was no expert on chickens. He had been selected for the coveted agricultural assignment because Ski's grandparents in Wisconsin had raised chickens, and Ski had spent many summers on their farm. Jesse had been selected because Ski vouched for him. It bothered Jesse that Dave Ski Chaika, who grew up in suburban Milwaukee, knew more about farming than Jesse Coulter, who had been born and raised in rural Arkansas. Jesse's mother had grown tomatoes in a pot on the back porch, but that's all the gardening experience he had as a child. His mother's parents lived in downtown Oklahoma City, and his father's parents were retired in Florida. Neither of those locations for visiting grandparents had offered opportunities for learning the science and art of agriculture. At the time, Jesse had been grateful to avoid the often back-breaking work of farming that some of his friends had to help their families with. Now he wished he had gained some farming experience before he joined the Army. Summers working at a retail store had not provided Jesse much useful knowledge of agriculture. "Cornpone, we're chicken herders, not veterinarians," Ski laughed. Chicken herder. Somehow he had gone from carrying a rifle as a U.S. Army infantry specialist to being assigned to an agricultural development team. He had endured the jokes about chicken ranching with good-natured humor. The job was important, and it came with perks. People working in agriculture were allowed an additional 800 calories per day above the standard ration. With UNEF cut off from Earth by the Ruhar fleet, humans were reduced to three sources of food. The dwindling amount of canned, irradiated, and freeze-dried food from Earth, nutrient mush provided by the Ruhar twice a day, although the Ruhar warned that those supplies were not endless, and whatever Earth crops they could grow on Paradise. "Hey, speaking of Cornpone," Jesse nodded toward the field of corn to the south. "When y'all think that will be ready?" Ski looked at the growing corn, scratched his head, then snorted in disgust at himself. Now he needed to get a freshly cleaned white cotton glove before he touched another chick. "There's an old farmer saying, knee-high by the 4th of July. You harvest corn when it's about 6-7 feet tall or more. So, he tried to judge the height of the corn plants. The agricultural experts in UNEF HQ thought corn might grow faster here than on Earth because there were no pests to eat the corn on Paradise. No pests, no need for pesticides that might stunt the plant's growth. "You know, I remember corn being way taller than knee-height the first week of July, so maybe that expression is outdated. I don't know, another 2 months?" "That's real useful," Cornpone scoffed. "My grandparents grew soybeans, not corn. And this," he pointed to the dark trees that grew thickly around the cleared fields, "is a jungle. Corn may grow faster here than in the Midwest, I don't know." "Well, don't tell anybody that you don't know. You're afraid they'll pull us off ag duty and we'll lose our extra rations?" Ski asked. Even with the additional calories, he was hungry all the time. He did not like the idea of surviving on 2 bowls of Ruhar-provided nutrient mush every day. "That, and I've gotten attached to my chicks," Jesse admitted. "They need me. Those chicks need water to drink, grain to eat, and air to breathe. They don't need you." "They need me to sing to them, Ski. Helps them grow faster," Jesse said, then launched into a rendition of an old Elvis classic. "Love me tender, love me sweet. All my dreams come..." "Damn!" Ski covered his ears. "Stupid. Now we needed to change both gloves." "Are you trying to kill the chicks? Your voice is bad enough to kill a full-sized chicken. Or a cow. Come on now. It's not that..." "Oh man, look out. Ship just jumped in." He pointed to the sky and involuntarily cringed. Lights in the sky used to mean Kristang warships enforcing their hold on the planet and protecting vulnerable UNEF troops on the ground. Or they meant unarmed Ruhar transport ships coming to haul away hamster evacuees who made the trip up the space elevator, and agricultural products that were shot into orbit by the launcher. Then, one fateful day, lights in the sky had meant a Ruhar raid. The raid when that lucky son of a bitch Joe Bishop became a hero by simply doing what any good soldier would have done. And later, lights in the sky were a full Ruhar battle group coming to take back control of the planet they called Gitanu, and that humans called Paradise. The lights in the sky on that day meant the Kristang were getting kicked off Paradise, and that UNEF troops had become prisoners of war. Now, lights in the sky meant one of two possible things. Most of the time, twinkling lights in the sky were Ruhar warships patrolling the area to prevent a Kristang invasion. Some of the time, twinkling lights were Kristang ships jumping in to harass the Ruhar and to raid the planet's infrastructure. According to intel shared over the UNEF Z-Phone internet, the Ruhar thought the Kristang still had a half-dozen ships in and around the Paradise system. These were Kristang ships that had been left there by the Theranin when those little green men decided they would no longer support the Lizard's effort to keep Paradise. The local Kristang force were ships that lacked the capability to travel to another star system or out to the local wormhole. Ships that were trapped and crewed by desperate lizards. That was not a good combination. The raids had been a serious problem at first, causing the Ruhar planetary government to worry that the raids would encourage humans to rise up and rebel against their POW status. For the first 2 weeks of raids, the Ruhar had confined the humans to camps, while seeds went unplanted and crops and fields were not tended. That was a serious setback to human efforts to grow enough food to survive without assistance from the Ruhar. After 2 weeks, the raids had settled down to one every couple weeks, and the Ruhar had cautiously relaxed restrictions on human movements. The raids had become infrequent, more of an annoyance than a threat. With a mere one or two ships at a time raiding an entire thinly settled planet, any one side on the surface was relatively safe. Humans assumed at first that they were safe from attack by the Kristang, until that changed. 2 months after UNEF surrendered to the Ruhar, a Kristang frigate jumped in, fired weapons, and jumped away. The target of the frigate's masers and missiles was a human warehouse. That warehouse became a smoking crater. 11% of all human food on Paradise was lost when that one warehouse was destroyed, and the Kristang had known they were targeting the human food supply. Before it jumped away, that frigate had broadcast a warning to UNEF. Humans who surrendered to the Ruhar were considered traitors. Humans on Paradise had two options: make futile gestures to resist the Ruhar and face slow, certain starvation, or lay down their weapons, grow food, and live to possibly fight another day. Which side humans would or even should fight on was still a damned good question. Jesse and Ski glanced over to the closest air raid shelter near the western edge of the field. It was crude, a hole in the ground covered with logs and topped with dirt and grass. From orbit, it hopefully would look like any other part of the field, unless an enemy ship happened to be at an angle where it could look directly into the entrance. The shelter had been thrown together hastily and was not intended for regular or long-term use. The roof leaked. Long roots of grass and shrubs reached down through the logs, which encouraged native bugs to take up residence. Because they were in a jungle, where every afternoon saw at least a brief thunderstorm sweep through, the floor of the shelter was a mud puddle. Last week, a work crew had installed a simple platform on the floor to keep occupants out of the ankle-deep water. Jesse was not confident the platform was still dry, as it had rained heavily the previous night. "What do you think?" Ski asked, mentally counting off the seconds since they'd seen the light in the sky. They were supposed to get an air raid warning on their Z-phones from Ruhar Command. That didn't always happen in time. Sometimes the Ruhar communications were jammed, sometimes were fooled by Kristang raiders being disguised as Ruhar civilian ships, and sometimes warnings simply did not get sent promptly. Warning humans about raids was not a big priority for the Ruhar. Generally, if you didn't see maser beams, railguns, or missiles coming down at you as burning streaks through the atmosphere within the first 30 seconds, you were most likely in the clear. Kristang ships didn't hang around long during a raid. They popped into high orbit, fired weapons, and jumped back away before the Ruhar defenses could target them. That quick strike tactic didn't always work. 2 weeks ago, Jesse and Ski had seen a Kristang ship flare into hot white light low on the northern horizon. That unlucky raider had been trapped by a damping field by a pair of Ruhar ships, and the brief firefight had favored the two hamster destroyers rather than the lizard frigate. "We're supposed to take cover," Cornpone responded, one eye on the sky and one eye on his precious flock of chicks. People were running across the field toward the three shelters. Other people were taking a wait-and-see attitude. Regulations called for taking shelter until it was positively determined that the ship overhead was not a threat. "I also think these chicks are worth more than you and me." "You got that right," Ski agreed. UNEF could afford to lose a couple soldiers. That would be two less mouths to feed. 20 seconds. Jesse looked at the sky again. Another telltale sign of trouble in the sky was ship-to-ship weapons fire, and he didn't see any. That wasn't always a reliable indicator. Masers and railguns weren't usually visible in the vacuum of space unless they hit something, and the initial launching boost flare of missiles was sometimes hidden enough by stealth effects that they couldn't be seen from the ground, not by the naked human eye, not in the bright sky of mid-morning. "Oh, hell. The shelter's probably a mud pit anyway." Just then, their Z-phones simultaneously squawked an all-clear signal. "Great," Ski laughed. "Perfect timing." A guy who had been running full speed across the field toward a shelter slowed to a stop and shouted an expletive that Ski couldn't quite hear. He could guess well enough what the guy said. Ski waved with a grin, and the guy returned a middle finger salute. Yeah, you too, buddy, Ski muttered, and looked up at the sky again, pondering something. What are you looking at now? Jesse asked. Trying to decide whether I was kinda hoping that ship was the Kristang coming back, Dave admitted. Coming back big time, to take the planet back again. Y'all better not hope the lizards come back, Jesse warned. We surrendered our weapons to the hamsters. The Ruhar loaned us equipment to clear the jungle and plow these fields, he pointed to the growing corn. We cooperated to grow our own food. That makes us traitors as far as the lizards are concerned. If they come back, we are screwed. Dave frowned and shrugged. And if the Kristang never come back, if we're stuck here with the Ruhar in charge, like, forever, then we're screwed either way. Welcome to the army, man. Jesse turned his attention back to the chicks. They needed to be fed again. Fed scarce grain that wasn't available to humans. Having eggs and milk would be great for the protein supply. Feeding chickens, cows, and goats also consumed a lot of calories that might better have been used as human food. Raising chickens for eggs and cows for milk was much more important for human morale than it was for nutrition. The prospect of a steady supply of eggs and milk promised that the future would be better, that humans on paradise would not always be POWs, that they would not live out the rest of their lives on a faraway alien world, that someday something would change and people could go home. He wasn't raising chickens, Jesse thought. He was growing hope. The chicks looked up at him hungrily and peeped loudly. I hear y'all, food's coming. Another day on paradise, man. Jesse shook his head. Another day on paradise. Chapter 1. Earth Orbit. My name is Joe Bishop, and sometimes I hate my life. Especially when a certain super-smart ancient alien artificial intelligence asshole almighty makes things difficult for me. Skippy, I complained in frustration. What the hell did you do? Damn it. Coming home from our mission that had saved the Earth again, I didn't exactly expect a ticker tape parade in New York City. Especially since no one had used ticker tape since, like... what was ticker tape anyway? I suppose I could ask Skippy if I wanted to risk death by boredom from a long, overly detailed explanation. It wasn't sticky like duct tape, I knew that. Confetti? Ticker tape was a type of confetti? Whatever confetti was. Or was confetti a type of Italian ice cream? No, that was gelato. Whatever. Anyway, while I didn't expect a parade, I also hadn't expected to land in a pile of shit up to my nose either. Except that's what happened. Right after the Flying Dutchman returned to Earth from our Spec Ops mission, and UNEF Command learned that we had prevented a Theranan ship from traveling all the way to our home planet. We had stopped a Theranan ship from coming to Earth, which likely would have led to the enslavement or extinction of humanity. Hey, great job, UNEF Command told me with one breath. With the next breath, they told me how much trouble I was in. How much trouble I'd been in, since shortly after the Flying Dutchman had jumped away from Earth orbit, on the mission we had not been expected to ever return from. What Skippy had neglected to tell me or anyone aboard our captured Theranan pirate ship was that he had planned a surprise before we jumped away. A nasty, totally unexpected, unpleasant surprise. Never, never trust a shiny beer can. You'll have to be more specific, Joe, Skippy said. What of all the things I've done are you bitching about this time? You know damned well what I mean. You put that Kristang troop ship on a timer and jumped it away from Earth orbit the day after we left. Oh, that. Hey, if you knew what I did, why did you ask what the hell I did? Is this one of those stupid human things where you ask what when you really mean something else like how or why? You know what I... Or did I just malign your whole species when the real problem is specifically Joe Bishop's stupidity? If so, I apologize to monkey kind. Sensing that he was only going to interrupt me again, I paused to collect my thoughts. I was in my office near the bridge. I'd gone there after getting royally chewed out by UNEF command. The Dutchman was in a stable orbit, and there wasn't anything for me to do as the captain other than finish my official mission report and prepare for the crew to go down to the surface, to go home. Against the odds, we had returned. That was my fault for not being specific. Why? The correct question is why. Why did you do it, and why didn't you tell me? Huh. This is kind of a multiple-choice question, Joe. I didn't tell you about it after we jumped away because there was no reason for me to do that, duh. If I did, you would have pestered me about it every freaking day, right? Could be. Probably, I admitted. Whatever. And if I had told you about it before we jumped away, you would have done something characteristically stupid, like trying to stop me. Which would not have worked, by the way. You don't know that for sure, I insisted. I don't. Of the two of us, which one has the most patience and is the most stubborn? As a test, let's see how long we can each hold our breath. Not funny, Skippy. All right, granted, you were going to do it anyway. The question still is why? Why jump that ship out of Earth orbit? It's circling the sun halfway to Mars now. We were counting. All of humanity was counting on getting access to that ship, access to its technology. I did it for you, Joe. For me. For a moment, I was speechless. Listen, Skippy, if you think putting an alien ship out of reach is a gift, please don't go shopping for my birthday. Skippy sighed. Not you specifically, Joe. I did it for your species. Because it entertains you to mess with us? Well, that too, he admitted. Man, I wish we'd been here to see the faces of major Earth leaders when they saw that their tempting source of alien technology jumped out of easy reach. Ha-ha! That would have been great. You know what? I'm sure there must be video of that somewhere. Let me search. We need that technology, damn it. Skippy, we got lucky learning about the Theranin sending a ship to Earth. If an alien ship ever does get here, we need advanced technology to defend ourselves. Advanced technology? Wait, you mean Kristang technology? Sometimes I forget how primitive your species is, that lizard technology impresses you. Okay, maybe I can see you monkeys being awed by bright, shiny things aboard that troop ship. Not everyone has your godlike level of technology, Skippy. We have to do things the hard way. We're getting off the subject as usual when I talk with you. Go back to explaining why you did this in order to help humanity. Exactly. A little more detail on that, please. Like, how does this help us? It removes a major reason for you monkeys to whack each other with sticks, and it gives you a reason to cooperate. Ah, you see it now. Yeah, I think so. Crap, he truly had been trying to help us. When that troop ship was in low Earth orbit, maybe a half dozen nations were capable of sending a team up there to take possession and then fight over it. But now that it's halfway to Mars, nations have to cooperate on a joint mission to get there. You are 100% accurate on that one, Joe. In my estimation, there was a better than 50-50 chance some nation would have nuked that troop ship into vapor in Earth orbit to prevent a rival nation from controlling its technology. Instead, for the past few months, your NASA has been cooperating with the space agencies of China, Europe, India, and also Japan. They are building a crude tin can of a spaceship to travel out to the troop ship. You might remember that before we left, there was an argument going on between the UNEF nations about who had rights to alien technology. One of the Kristang dropships that I shot down crashed in shallow water off the Philippines, and four navies almost got into a shooting war over recovering it. This is after international cooperation and sacrifice aboard the Dutchman saved all of your miserable monkey asses. I remember. That was a minor dust-up just before the Dutchman departed. I figured it was going to amount to nothing more than harsh words being exchanged, political posturing to please each nation's domestic audience, and a negotiated agreement. Smashed lizard technology wasn't worth fighting over. It especially was not worth fighting over when the nations involved had such a monumental amount of work to do rebuilding our planet from the ravages of the Kristang. Perhaps I was underestimating the short-sightedness of political leaders. Your motive was good, Skippy, and I see why you couldn't announce it beforehand. If he had jumped the troop ship away before the Dutchman left, the UNEF governments would have insisted that we recover that ship before departing for the wormhole, which, because those same governments had taken so long to make the inevitable, obvious decision, we did not have time for. And instead of being angry with and hating each other, those governments now all agree on one thing. They all blame me. That is totally unfair, Joe. They're not going to blame you, because they already knew you were a sneaky little beer can. And they won't blame themselves for trusting you. That leaves me at fault. Although I don't know what they expected me to do.
I guess I'm at fault for not persuading you not to do something I didn't know you were going to do. It's not your fault, Joe. I should have left a message to explain why I did it after the ship jumped away. Even if you had baked a cake and delivered that message in person, it would still be my fault, Skippy. I was the mission commander. It was almost time for me to take the Silver Eagles off my uniform and put the sergeant stripes back on. Unless they were going to bust me back to Private Bishop before I left the ship. Anyway, that's all water under the bridge now. We need to go get that ship. As I already explained to those dum-dums at UNEV Command, that ship's reactor is in cold shutdown, and I will not help you ignorant monkeys screw with it. I used the last energy in the jump drive capacitors to jump it away, so it can't jump back. And if you're thinking of jumping the Dutchman out there, good luck programming a jump accurately enough without me. Also, darn, I just discovered a fault in the calibration of our jump drive coils. I need to take them offline. I hate when that happens. Could take a long time to fix, or a short time, if you know what I mean. You forget that we have 2 Theranin dropships, and we can mostly fly those without you. Ha! No, I did not forget that, mi amigo. We have 2 and only 2 dropships. It's too hazardous to send a single dropship out that far, so you will need to send both, and they will both have to stay there for a very long time while your idiot scientists try to figure how to get the troopship back to Earth. Good luck with that, by the way. During that time, we will not be able to use those 2 dropships to bring crew and supplies up to the Dutchman. Crap. You planned this? Nope. I got lucky. It just worked out exceptionally well for me. According to your underdeveloped understanding of luck, that is. Remember, we did not expect to come back here. If you monkeys still want that troopship, you are going to have to do it the hard way. After I landed at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Ohio for debriefing by UNEV Command, the U.S. military, and CIA, I received a thorough ass-chewing. I mean, there was a line of officers and government officials a mile long lined up for an all-you-can-eat buffet, and my hide was on the menu. They had been pissed at me before we returned about the Kristang troopship being inaccessible. Our unexpected return had given them a new reason to throw me in the manure pile. Within 5 minutes of us contacting UNEV Command after we jumped into orbit, I had transmitted my mission report and summary. All the other officers on board had sent their own mission reports, which I had not censored in any way. 5 minutes after my own report reached UNEV Command, I was explaining and defending myself to outraged parties from multiple nations. Perhaps that was the good aspect of me being in such trouble. It had united the 5 nations of UNEV in collective indignant outrage toward me. Yay, teamwork! My explaining of my decisions lasted 4 full days. After the first 2 hours, I learned to stop defending myself and simply accept the ass-chewing. Truthfully, they had raised grilling to such an art that it was kind of a privilege to witness it, even if the person getting grilled was me. By the time they were done, I was burnt so crispy that you wouldn't have been able to discern me from the charcoal. Assuming, that is, that you understand my grilling analogy. Skippy attempted to defend me, which I think likely made matters worse. If UNEV Command was disappointed in me, they now thoroughly distrusted our alien AI. In the eyes of UNEV Command, Skippy had stolen a priceless starship from them. Until we returned with our fresh intel, Earth had no way to know for sure that there weren't a dozen Kristang starships lurking in the vicinity of Earth. Without the troopship's technology, Earth was completely defenseless. From the viewpoint of UNEV Command, if Skippy could not be trusted to keep a Kristang ship in Earth orbit, how could he be trusted to keep his word and shut down the wormhole near Earth? Damn. I had not even considered that issue until we returned. The whole time while we were away on our luxury cruise, UNEV Command had been panicked that the local wormhole was still open, that a fleet of pissed-off aliens would be jumping into Earth orbit without warning. And the best source of advanced alien technology had been jumped out of reach by a clearly untrustworthy alien AI. For all UNEV Command knew, Skippy had sold out the merry band of pirates and delivered the Dutchman back to the Theranin in exchange for help from a more advanced species. People on Earth had been frightened and angry, going home at night to their loved ones and not knowing whether that night was the last for humanity. When we unexpectedly returned, and I proudly and sort of smugly announced that we had again saved the world by foiling an attempt to send a Theranin ship to Earth, all their fear and anger was transferred to me. Hell, I don't blame them. I'd be angry at that jerk Joe Bishop if I was them. The first night after debriefing, thoroughly exhausted, I collapsed into a bunk. Sleep should have come immediately. To my body clock that was used to Dutchman standard time, it was 04:30, and I had been harshly questioned for over 14 hours. Maybe I was too stunned to sleep. More likely, what kept me from sleep was thinking that the other merry band of pirates, especially the leaders like Chang, Sims, and Smythe, were probably also being subjected to unfriendly interrogation by UNEF. In my debriefing, I had stated many times that decisions during the mission were my responsibility alone. UNEF knew that was what a commander was expected to say. "This sucks, Joe," Skippy commented angrily through my Z-phone. "You saved this unworthy ball of dirt again, and they're upset with you. Ungrateful jerks." "They're not ungrateful, Skippy. They did commend me and the entire crew for our actions against the Surveyor ship."
"Yeah, they commended you for like 2 seconds before nitpicking and second-guessing every freaking decision you made along the way."
"They do have a point, Skippy. They made me the mission commander and they gave me only 2 real objectives."
"Which you totally accomplished."
"We accomplished the first objective, shutting down the wormhole. The second objective, that is equally important, was preventing aliens from learning that humans are flying around the galaxy in a pirate ship. UNEF Command thinks the major reason that I didn't manage to blow that objective was through pure luck. Looking back, I think they may be right about that."
"Joe, the only decision they have a problem with is landing on Newark instead of letting the entire crew die aboard the Dutchman when the life support power ran out. Those dum-dums forget that if the crew hadn't landed on Newark, we would never have learned about that Surveyor ship's mission."
"That's not relevant, Skippy. At the time I had made the decision to land on Newark and risk aliens discovering us, I did not know that we would learn about the Surveyor ship. UNEF is evaluating the decisions I made based on the information available to me at the time. They are questioning my judgment, not our results."
"What?"
he sputtered.
"You can't separate the two. UNEF Command thinks you should have condemned our entire pirate crew to death just to avoid taking even an entirely reasonable risk."
"I wouldn't have been condemning the crew to death, Skippy. You were already doing that." There was another of his signature pauses.
"That hurt, Joe. How do you figure that? My rebuilding the ship out of moon dust saved the crew."
"No, that was only temporary. After you rebuilt the ship and we left Newark, you and I talked about whether humans could fly the Dutchman by ourselves. You said it is impossible. The crew was going to die in cold and lonely space anyway after you contacted the Collective and left us. Remember? I tried to make a bargain with you to bring the ship back to Earth so the crew could land here safely. Then just the two of us could go out to contact the Collective. Based on what I knew at the time, the risk I took by landing on Newark only temporarily postponed the crew's inevitable deaths. If I had decided against landing on Newark, it would have been because I figured we were all going to die soon anyway, as soon as we found a working comm node for you." There was another pause, longer this time.
"Crap. I'm sorry, Joe. This is my fault?"
He sounded genuinely remorseful.
"No," I said quickly to reassure him.
"No, Skippy. I was the commander. The decision was 100% mine."
"This isn't a clear wrong or right issue," Skippy's voice reflected his frustration. "It's purely a matter of judgment."
"You are correct, and UNEF disagrees with the judgment I made." From just the first day of debriefing, it was pretty clear that UNEF would not be entrusting me with command in any future missions. Command of a mission from which we weren't expected to return, yes. Command of a mission with a more complicated objective, no. UNEF didn't trust my judgment. I was too young, too immature, too inexperienced, and too reckless in the opinion of UNEF. After 14 hours of explaining over and over why I had risked the failure of the primary mission objective, I was beginning to question my own judgment. Maybe they were right. After all, I had flown the Dutchman right into an ambush. Later, a whole lot of things could have gone wrong on Newark, and the long road trip we took across the surface of Newark in our Barney Wego RV was for nothing. The comm node and AI we recovered were both useless. Also, that RV sank. Don't forget that little detail. In UNEF Command's view, that was yet another shining example of my genius leadership. Not. The fact is, I actually got lucky when Skippy discovered the Theranin plan to send a ship to Earth. In UNEF's opinion, stopping that ship was the one good thing I did after we shut down the wormhole on our way outbound. Yes, In order for UNEF to not be completely disgusted with me, all I needed to do was simply save the freaking world. Not that I'm bitter about it. Skippy still tried to comfort me. Hey, it was what we found on Newark that most convinced me to temporarily set aside my quest for contacting the Collective. So, landing on Newark is the whole reason I agreed to come back to Earth. That, and the fact that as Commander I ordered the ship to come back here. Oh, yeah, sure. He almost stuttered on the words. That too. Joe, is there anything I can do to help you? Jump that troop ship back into Earth orbit? I suggested hopefully. Anything other than that, I meant. You may not be flying monkeys like in The Wizard of Oz, but you will have to fly up there by yourselves if you want access to that ship. Or hey, how about this? The troop ship's orbit is somewhat elliptical. I calculate that ship's orbit will come within 1,000,000 miles of Earth within the next 6,000 years. If that helps. Good night, Skippy. Skippy's credibility, and by extension my own, had been severely damaged by revelations in my mission report. UNEF Command was disturbed and intrigued by what we had learned about Elder Sites, about Newark, and, most importantly, about Skippy himself. The first time we came to Earth, the story Skippy told UNEF was that he had been part of the Elder Civilization. The information that Skippy had been able to give us, more or less, matched the limited info that UNEF had heard from other sources. An ancient species now known as the Elders departed the galaxy long ago, and no one knew what happened to them. The Elders had created the wormhole network. Little was known about the Elders. Scattered bits and pieces of their technology were highly prized by current species, although use of Elder technology had to be done very, very carefully. When the Rindaloo fought the Maxalks in the original battle that began the endless war that still raged across the galaxy, both sides had used Elder devices as weapons. Use of destructive Elder technology had activated previously unknown machines now called Sentinels. These machines devastated both sides of the conflict equally. Devastated as in scorched planets and scoured entire solar systems of life. Wherever the Sentinels struck, nothing lived, and nothing could stop them. After wiping out large areas of both Rindaloo and Maxalk's territory in mere days, the Sentinels had disappeared. They were still out there, waiting. Now we knew that someone had used Elder technology to destroy a moon and push a planet out of orbit. Someone had done that after the Elders left the galaxy and before the Rindaloo discovered electricity. Skippy admitted that he had no idea who had done such terrible things. As far as he knew, there were no intelligent beings in the galaxy during the time between the Elders and the Rindaloo. The fact that Skippy was baffled called into question the accuracy and usefulness of his vast knowledge base. After Newark, Skippy was not even sure who he was. Why, UNEF asked me, should we trust an alien AI who doesn't know his own nature? Perhaps everything that Skippy thought he knew was wrong. We couldn't trust his analysis, even if UNEF trusted that shiny beer can's intentions. And they didn't. I didn't have a good answer for why we should trust Skippy, other than that he had helped us so far. His help had saved our planet, twice. And if we planned to take the Dutchman back out to verify there were no other starships on their way to Earth, we absolutely needed Skippy. Even if he was an untrustworthy little beer can. Paradise. The Krestang frigate, to seek glory in battle is glorious, suddenly appeared in orbit above Perdassus, the world called Paradise by the traitorous humans, and Getanu by the dishonorable Ruhar. The ship did not bother to deploy a stealth field. The gamma ray burst of its jump in could not be masked, and the ship would not remain in the area long enough to play cat and mouse games with the Ruhar ships protecting the planet. Speed, not stealth, was the frigate's ally that day. The frigate would attack the planet in order to harass the Ruhar defenders, and as soon as it was able, the frigate launched missiles and fired maser cannons at pre-selected targets on the surface. But its primary mission that day was to gather information, not merely to inflict minor, if annoying, damage. The Glory's captain paid only scant attention as all three of his missiles were intercepted and destroyed by the maser beams of the Ruhar ships before his weapons could cause any damage. No matter. The missiles had served their purpose of tying up the Ruhar defenders while the frigate scanned the surface and the space around Paradise. The attention of the frigate's captain shifted rapidly between two displays. The first showed the incoming sensor data, indicating the scan was already 57% complete. The second display monitored the known Ruhar ships and predicted how soon the Glory would need to jump away. This second display the captain watched with a combination of anxiety and mistrust. The predictive ability of the computer behind that system was known to be right only 42% of the time. The Krestang, who built, designed, and now maintained the system, based on concepts stolen from the Jirapatha, insisted that their system worked correctly. The problem, they said, was lack of data from the frigate's inadequate sensors.
"Maser beam near miss, Captain," the ship's second-in-command reported. "Another. We were bracketed that time."
The real problem, thought the Glory's captain as he noted that the planned sensor sweep was now 71% complete, was the unforgiving math of physics. Sensor data crawled to the ship at the slow speed of light. Ruhar ships could jump faster than light. An enemy ship could appear on top of the Glory before the frigate even knew the defending ship existed. What saved raiding ships was their own ability to quickly jump away and altitude. The Glory had jumped in high enough so that it could form an outbound jump point to escape, but low enough that the planet's gravity well prevented defending Ruhar ships from jumping in accurately. Even a Ruhar ship with a well-calibrated jump drive, performing a relatively short jump, could only be assured of emerging within 30,000 kilometers of the Glory. There was no way around the distortion of the gravity well, with the limited technology available to the Ruhar or Krestang. A separation of 30,000 kilometers was far enough that the Glory could safely jump away after its shields absorbed one or two direct hits from maser beams. More than two maser beams, or a single hit from a rail gun or smart missile, would burn through the frigate's thin shields. Frigate captains were trained to jump in, shoot, and jump away before enemy fire could find them. The scan was now 84% complete. The Glory's parameters for this mission had been a successful 75% scan. An additional 10% would allow the frigate's crew bragging rights, without earning her captain a reprimand for needlessly endangering his precious ship. Bravery to the point of foolhardiness was normally expected in Krestang captains, but not this time. There were only 7 Krestang ships still around the Paradise system, and none of them could be risked without strong assurance that the risk was worth the potential gain. The small remaining task force was centered around one elderly cruiser, with its escorts of 2 support ships, 3 frigates, and 1 destroyer. The task force had only 2 purposes, to force the Ruhar to maintain a substantial naval presence in the Pardassus system and to gather intelligence, to provide intelligence that hopefully would convince the clan's leadership that one strong push would take the planet back. The dishonorable Ruhar and their allies, the Jirapatha, may have decisively defeated the Krestang-Theranin coalition forces in the sector for the moment, but even the triumphant Ruhar could not be strong everywhere at once. The planet Pardassus could still be retaken, but that possibility grew fainter every day. The ship was rocked by a glancing blow from a maser beam. The Ruhar Defense Force had narrowed his location enough to begin using targeting sensors. The Glory had been maneuvering randomly since it jumped in, so that by the time a light, slow maser beam reached its intended target, the target was no longer there. Sensor scan was now 87% complete. The shields had protected the ship from the maser beam, but that dissipated energy was now a cloud of high-energy particles surrounding the ship and degrading the effectiveness of the sensors. The Glory's captain ordered to jump away, and the little frigate disappeared 61 seconds after it jumped in. Jumping away so soon after jumping in rendered it impossible for the frigate's jump drive to have any kind of accuracy, but that did not matter. All the frigate's crew cared about was getting away without emerging inside a planet or moon. Anywhere else was safely empty space. While the ship's crew were preparing for a series of jumps back to the task force's gathered ships, the Glory's captain quickly skimmed through highlights of the sensor data. Strangely, the Ruhar did not appear to be putting any effort into stiffening their planet's defenses against raiders. The Ruhar did not consider the planet important enough to expend the resources, or the Ruhar were now stretched so thin that they did not have the resources to deploy. Either circumstance was favorable to the Krestang. There was something else interesting in the sensor data. Substantial areas of the southern continent, mostly covered by jungle, had been cleared for crops. Human crops. There were large areas of fields growing plants suited to human biology. A closer look at the sensor data revealed newly constructed crude settlements populated by humans near the fields. and in the fields were Ruhar heavy equipment, assisting the humans with clearing the jungle, planting and harvesting crops. Despite being ordered to resist the Ruhar by their rightful patrons, the Kristang, the traitorous, cowardly humans appeared to be wholeheartedly working with the Ruhar. Those large fields, the Glory's captain thought, would make tempting, easy targets for a raiding ship's maser beams. The traitorous humans needed to be taught a lesson by true warriors. Chapter 2. Earth. After getting grilled by one group after another for 4 straight days, I wrangled permission to leave the base. Just me, no escort. I wasn't under arrest, and although I still had the big red button app on my Z-phone that could activate the Dutchman's weapons, it wasn't necessary. Unlike last time, there was a skeleton crew aboard the ship. I didn't need to be on duty 24/7 to protect the planet. Besides, we now knew there were no Kristang or Theranin ships on this side of the local wormhole. So I had the night off. All I needed to do was report back for another debriefing at 0800 the next morning, Friday morning. I was hoping they would let me have the weekend off. I was also certainly not betting on it. "Hey, Joe, you think your weekend sucked?" Skippy said to me as I was changing into civilian clothes. "That was nothing compared to what I had to go through." "Oh, yeah, sorry. I meant to ask you about that." "How did it go?" UNEF had come up with some astonishingly moronic idea for Skippy to be examined by psychologists and AI experts. UNEF's thinking, if that word even applied, was there was something wrong with Skippy that made him act like such an immature asshole. I had told them no, there is nothing wrong with Skippy. He is simply an incredibly powerful, smart, amoral little beer can. Being an asshole was just his personality. UNEF didn't listen to me. Fortunately, UNEF's search for humans who were considered experts in the field of artificial intelligence ended quickly, since humanity had not yet developed true AI. Asking a human to examine Skippy would be like asking a flatworm to look under the hood of a car and tell you why it won't start. The few people working in the field of AI who were contacted by UNEF naturally would have given anything to speak with Skippy, but they all told UNEF that any knowledge transfer would be one way, and Skippy refused to cooperate. I expected that any psychologist would have told UNEF that they had no way to usefully examine the psyche of an alien artificial intelligence. I underestimated the arrogance of psychologists. Despite having exactly 0 frame of reference for what constituted normal behavior for an elder AI, the psychologists plowed ignorantly ahead. "It went better for me than for them," Skippy chuckled. "You know what? The experience was actually mildly entertaining for a while until I got bored with it. One of them had a nervous breakdown. Another one started crying and ended the conversation. He's in therapy now." "Skippy, you didn't have to do that." "Hey, you did warn them. It's not my fault they ignored you." "Morons." "Oh, boy." I had warned them. Skippy knew just about everything there was to know about a person, and he was an expert at pushing people's buttons. Whatever a person's weakness or trigger points were, he would find them and use them. What the hell had they been thinking, trying to peel back the mind of such an immensely intelligent being? "Don't do it again, please." "No problem, Joe. That little farce is over. Although they did conclude that whatever is wrong with me is your fault." "What? How the hell did they figure that?" "Well, reading from their preliminary report, they're saying the alien AI is engaging in classic mirroring behavior with its companion, Joe Bishop. It is because of Bishop's immature personality that the Skippy being's behavior is..." "I don't need to read the rest of this BS to you, Joe. The gist of it is that if a different person had discovered me in that dusty warehouse, a person the psychologists consider more mature, then I would be more serious and cooperative." "Oh. Crap. Another reason for UNEF to be pissed at me." "Well, they're, not right about that, are they?" Skippy made a raspberry sound. "Ha! No way, dude. I've told you before, me being an asshole is just me. That's not going to change. Especially not because some bacteria with a degree in psychology says so." "Oh. Good, then." A bus took me into town. All I wanted was a cheeseburger, a beer, and time to myself. There was a crowd of reporters outside the base fence, all hoping to get an interview with anyone who had been on the Theranin Star Carrier. In my civilian clothes, on an ordinary bus, and with a baseball cap pulled down over my eyes, I sailed right through the reporters. Once I got off the bus, I wandered down some side streets. I wanted to find a place that wouldn't be crowded with people from the base. Finally, I found a window that advertised wine flights, whatever that is, and I saw a group of people wearing suits go in. In my experience, this type of place was not likely to be crowded with off-duty soldiers. It was about half full already. I found a spot at the bar, ordered a cold beer and a cheeseburger, and half-watched a college basketball game on the TV. The cheeseburger was merely okay. It may have been my mood that was the problem. While I was taking a sip of beer, someone jostled me from behind, and I almost spilled my drink. Sorry, said a woman as she plunked her purse on the bar. This place is crowded tonight. She caught the bartender's attention. Lemon drop martini, please. Oh, hi. Hey, I've seen you on the base, I said truthfully. She had been in the cafeteria several times, and I'd seen her in hallways, too. She was a civilian. I guess she worked at Wright-Patterson. Her ID card was partly sticking out of her purse. You're Joe, right? She asked. You're one of the X-4 Starship crew? She added that last question quietly. When she first sat down next to me, I had half turned away, assuming she was there with friends and didn't want to be hit on by guys that night. Now I was paying attention. She'd sat down next to me because it was one of only two seats left at the bar, it being happy hour on a Thursday night. Short, thick, black hair, in a cut that I think is called a bob, but I am certainly no expert on women's hairstyles. Her hair was longer in front than the back. It framed her face nicely. Brown eyes. She had a tan from someplace she'd been on vacation, but not recently. It was starting to fade. Late 20s, maybe? I'm a bad judge of age. Cute. Very cute. And a nice smile. She tucked a badge in her purse and slung it over her knee, the way women do when bars aren't smart enough to install purse hooks under the bar top. Offering a hand, she added, I'm Rachel. I work in IT support at the Base Network Center. Sergeant Joe Bishop. I shook her hand for what I hoped was the right amount of time, not too firm, but not trying to crush her either. A handshake that hopefully said, I am not a creep, and please, please, please stay here and talk with me. Also, hopefully it did not convey the desperation I was feeling either. That was asking a lot from a handshake. Hello, Sergeant Joe, she said as she glanced around. I fervently wished she wasn't looking for her friends, or worse, her boyfriend. She wasn't wearing a wedding ring. What brought you here? This place is out of the way. After wearing a uniform every day aboard the ship, I want to be a civilian for a while. I pointed to the civilian shirt I was wearing. I know what you mean, she laughed. And it was a truly wonderful sound. I was in the Air Force. Wearing a uniform makes it easy for women. You don't have to put together an outfit every day. Hey, guys just do a sniff test on whatever clothes are on top of the pile of laundry on the floor, I admitted. You guys are so lucky, she said, and lightly punched me on the shoulder. Things were looking good. Now I have to find something business casual to wear 5 days a week. If we have a high-level meeting, then I have to dress up. She took a sip of a lemon-drop martini. You were on that alien starship? On behalf of all the men and women trapped on Paradise, I could at least entertain Rachel with UNEF's current cover story. A cover story that had been pounded into my head over and over. Telling her the story also gave me reason to lean closer to her, to be heard over the noisy bar. Yes, I said, sticking to the cover story. I was on the starship. I went to space, and I had been on Paradise. It was a nice planet, nothing special. The parts of Paradise that I had seen were kind of like Kansas and the Amazon. Not that I'd ever been to either of those places on Earth. We humans didn't fly the starship that was now in orbit. We were just passengers on a Theranan ship. The Theranan were little green men. I had seen them, but never spoken with one. That part was the truth. No, I didn't know when the X-4 would be coming back from Paradise. I had not been on Paradise in a long time. That was the truth again. And no, I hadn't had contact with Paradise, and I didn't know where the Theranan starship would be taking us next. I didn't even know when or if I would be going into space next. Actually, there was a lot of truth mixed into UNEF's cover story. Most of what I needed to say was that I didn't know things that I honestly didn't know. That made it easy to remember. You are only passengers aboard the Theranan ship? She asked quizzically. Why did you bring pilots? I saw people wearing Air Force flight suits get off the dropship when you landed.
Oh, yeah. UNEF had a cover story for that also. When we were on Paradise, we flew captured Ruhar aircraft. The Kristang trained us on a planet we called Camp Alpha before we went to Paradise, I added nervously. To my relief, she nodded and seemed to buy the story.
Don't worry. I won't ask where you went this last time.
After enforced sobriety on Camp Alpha, Paradise, and aboard the Flying Dutchman, I was being careful to limit myself to beer. While I talked with Rachel, I nursed the same beer I had started with. Raising the glass to drain the last of the beer, I was jostled from behind again and spilled it on the bar. Some of it splashed on my shirt. Rachel handed me a napkin and tried to catch the bartender's attention. "It's okay," I told her. "I have to watch what I'm drinking. It's been a long time since I've had much alcohol." Rachel had been about to order another lemon drop. She dropped her hand and looked around.
"This place is crowded. It's karaoke night," she pointed to the stage.
"Oh, no," a loud but muffled voice came from the Z-phone in my pocket. "No karaoke for you, Joe. Your singing voice scares animals and small children."
"Excuse me," I said to Rachel and pulled out my Z-phone.
"Skippy," I whispered as quietly as I could to still be heard over the noisy bar. "This is not a good time."
Rachel's eyes widened, and she leaned closer to me. "Is that Skippy?" Now it was my turn to be surprised.
UNEF Command had told us that rumors of a Skippy had gotten out, as was inevitable. But that annoying beer can didn't know when to be quiet. "Skippy the Magnificent at your service, Rachel, my dear." "Not now, Skippy. I'm serious," I said, and sat on the phone. Look, Rachel,
I've heard of someone called Skip.
As she spoke, the karaoke started, with some drunk guy loudly warbling a pop song off-key.
"Joe," she said, with her lips practically brushing my ear because the place was so loud. "Let's go someplace else."
"That would be great," I said without hesitation. The someplace else was a coffee shop down the street. We got coffees. Technically, what she got looked like an ice cream sundae with a tiny splash of coffee somewhere in it. Lots of whipped cream and caramel sauce, and a straw. That did not qualify as coffee, in my opinion. I paid for the coffees, although she used her frequent coffee buyer card, so I guess that she got coffee there often. The shop wasn't empty as I had hoped. That disappointed me, because I'd been hoping for it to be quieter. It was a hipster douchebag with a carefully tended scruffy beard, a bowler hat, and an ironic t-shirt playing acoustic guitar in the corner. He had brought a group of enthusiastic friends, but apparently left the talent behind in his car. It actually turned out great, to my delight. Rachel and I had to sit close to hear each other. The background noise meant I didn't need to worry about being overheard, and the terrible singing of the hipster gave us something to laugh about. First, I told her the official UNEF cover story that I had been given in case anyone asked about Skippy. Skippy is the nickname humans used for the AI that ran the Theranin ship. He is super intelligent and rightfully disdainful of lowly humans, and he tends to involve himself in our lives even when we're not on the ship. Rachel could tell that further inquiry about Skippy, the Theranin ship, or Paradise were not welcome. Being ex-military and having a clearance to work on Air Force computers, she knew that certain subjects were on a need-to-know basis, so she was cool about changing the subject.
"Joe Bishop. Is there any chance you are that Joe Bishop? The Barney guy?"
"Yes," I admitted sheepishly. I'd seen her checking her phone on the walk from the bar. She probably had Googled me. Talking about events in the public record was safe. Anything that happened before I took the space elevator up from Ecuador. I told her what I hoped was a humorous account of how I became known as Barney. Rachel laughed at my story. Then I asked about her. This wasn't me doing the guy thing of letting a woman talk so I could get into her pants. I was genuinely interested in her. And not only because she is a woman. After being captain of a private ship, commander of everyone I saw on a daily basis, I was desperate to simply talk with someone like the normal people talk. Rachel was a good listener, and as she told me about her life, I sat and enjoyed being a regular person. Sitting in a coffee shop in a typical American city with a person who I could not potentially order into deadly combat was cathartic. We stayed late enough at the coffee shop that we finished our coffees, and I got us decafs, and we split a scone. The hipster guy ran out of folk songs to mangle and finished his set about 10:15, 15 minutes before the coffee shop closed for the night.
We took a hint and walked outside. "Can I walk you to your car?" I asked awkwardly. Clearly, I was out of practice. "No need," she said, and even in the night she must have seen my face fall. "I live across the street." She pointed to an apartment building. "Oh," I said with relief. "Well, that explains the frequent coffee drinker card." "Yes," she laughed. "I spend too much money in there." There was an awkward moment of silence that most guys would typically use as an opportunity for some lame hint about going to her place. "Rachel, this has been great." "Thank you," I blurted out before my testicles could stop me. "No," they were shouting, "no!" "I have another meeting at 8 o'clock tomorrow morning, so I'm going to head back to the base. I'll see you around on Monday." The truth was, I really did have a great time talking with her, and I didn't want to spoil the pleasant buzz by her having to let me down, so I did it for her. She seemed surprised, but also mildly relieved to avoid the inevitable awkwardness. Paradise. Baterna Logelia frowned as the human commander left her office. She did not like lying to, or at the very least misleading, the poor humans. Although the humans had come to Gitanu as lackeys of the hated Kristang, Baterna felt sorry for them, and even some measure of affection for some of them. In a way, although the planet had been under the control of the occupying Kristang back then, she felt a pang of nostalgia for the time when the humans had called her the Burgermeister. The current human commander was from an ethnic subgroup the humans called Chinese. All humans looked pretty much the same to her. She didn't appreciate the significance of genetic, cultural, or political differences. Also, she simply didn't care. She had other more pressing issues to absorb her attention. For some reason, that seemed to be important to the humans. Command of their United Nations Expeditionary Force rotated regularly among the five nations who constituted the combat force, or what had been a combat force before the Ruha re-established control over the planet. Whatever it had once been, the human force was now mostly scattered across the southern continent, from which the few Ruha residents had been evacuated. The humans could have the southern continent they called Lemuria, and hopefully within a few years the humans would be self-sufficient there. That time could not come soon enough for Baterna, because the humans were both a constant distraction and a substantial drain on scarce resources. It was why those resources were so scarce that was the reason she misled the human commander, and misled the Ruha residents of Gitanu. The Ruha government, Baterna knew, did not want to keep Gitanu, had not intended or wanted to recapture the planet at all. Gitanu had only been the bait to lure a major Kristang Therenan task force into battle so it could be trapped and destroyed. That Ruha Jarapatha force was not supposed to actually retake control of Gitanu, but as the battle developed and spread rapidly across the sector, the situation became highly fluid. The success of the initial attack wildly exceeded the expectations of Ruha Jarapatha command, opening additional opportunities. When intelligence was received that two Kristang battle groups intended to use Gitanu as a place to make a last stand, possibly ransacking the planet in the process, the local Ruha commander had reacted quickly and diverted his ships to jump into orbit. Now the Ruha were stuck with a planet they didn't want. The planet held two troublesome populations, humans and native Ruha, who outlasted the Kristang evacuation effort. Those native Ruha now expected their government to assist in rebuilding the planet and bringing the evacuees back. "Be patient," Baterna had to tell the natives. "Those who were evacuated will be returned in due time," she lied. "The military situation in the sector is still unsettled," she told them truthfully. "A ceasefire has been negotiated, but there have been incidents. It is still too dangerous for civilian transport ships to make the journey to Gitanu," she said. And that was also the truth. What the government instructed her to lie about was the intended endgame, giving Gitanu back to the Kristang. Before the recent wormhole shift, the planet that the Ruha knew as Gitanu, the Kristang claimed as Perdassus, and the humans called Paradise, had been roughly equally conveniently located for both the Ruha and the Kristang. After the shift, the closest wormhole was substantially further away from the Ruha than it was for the Kristang. If they had not already occupied the planet, the Ruha would never have bothered going there. The Ruha government did not want Gitanu now. The wormhole shift had opened much more alluring and less expensive opportunities. Kitanu was too sparsely populated and too vulnerable to bother keeping. In order to assure the planet's safety, the Ruhar would need to permanently station a major battle group in the system, and Kitanu was simply not worth that effort and expense. So, the Ruhar were secretly negotiating with a coalition of major Kristang clans to give Kitanu back to the Kristang in exchange for Kristang concessions of more valuable territory elsewhere. That would be bad for the native Ruhar, who would be forcibly evacuated by their own government. It would be absolutely disastrous for the humans. There was nowhere to evacuate humans to, and the Ruhar certainly would not be taking their former oppressors with them. Humans on Kitanu would be left under control of the cruel Kristang, who now considered their former clients as traitors. So when the human commander of their UNEF came into her office to discuss his many legitimate concerns, Paterna had to nod and smile and assure him that they could work together. And they would. Right up until the point when the Ruhar betrayed their slowly developing trust. Earth. I slept great and woke up the next morning in a good mood. The worst of the debriefing had to be over, I figured. The session that day wasn't bad. The people running the debriefing seemed to have run out of questions for the moment, and I had run out of things to say. I had accepted that UNEF and the U.S. military were disappointed and angry with me, and my acceptance took away some of the fun for them to berate me yet again. By 15:30, we ended the session for the day, and the next meeting wasn't scheduled until Monday. I had a whole weekend free. So, I was completely surprised when Rachel called me that afternoon.
"Hi, Joe, this is Rachel," she said.
"Oh, hi. How'd you get my number?" I looked at my Z-phone. As far as I knew, a Z-phone did not have a phone number. When we got our original Z-phones on Camp Alpha, they were keyed to us. To contact someone, you looked them up in the UNEF directory by name or unit.
"You texted me last night," she answered cautiously. "I was wondering how you got my number."
"I did?" "Joe, you dum-dum," Skippy broke into the call, and I assume Rachel couldn't hear him on her end. "I texted her with, 'Thank you for a very nice evening. Clearly, you have no idea what you are doing with women. Damn, you are a dumbass sometimes.'" I gestured at my Z-phone with my middle finger, knowing Skippy would be watching through the camera. "Oh, yeah, I did, Rachel. Sorry, it's been a very long week. I got your number from the base operator." I winced at that lie, hoping she wouldn't think that was creepy of me. "Well, I'm not, you know, stalking you or anything." OMG, what an idiot I am. If she didn't think I was creepy before, then mentioning stalking should have set off her alarms. But she laughed. Someone up there liked me, and I didn't mean a shiny beer can.
"That is good to know, Joe. Listen, if you're not busy tonight, would you be interested in dinner?"
"That depends." I tried to be smooth while inside I was shaken. "I'm not familiar with fabulous Dayton, Ohio. Do you know a place that has people who can actually sing?" She laughed again.
"Dayton has a bigger supply of ironic hipsters than you might expect, but we can try to avoid them."
"Wow, Joe," Skippy said after Rachel ended the call. "Did you just have a real girl ask you on a date?
I thought there were no more surprises in the universe." "A real woman, Skippy. And it's not such a surprise." I stopped, a bad thought running with a chill down my spine. "Hey, Skippy. This Rachel. She said she works in IT, is that right? She's not an undercover intel type, is she? She did ask a lot of questions last night." I was afraid that our meeting the previous night may not have been the coincidence that it seemed. UNEF sending an attractive woman to see if I blew our cover story was exactly what I expected them to do. "Nope. She is genuinely who she says she is. She did talk and text with friends today, telling them that she met a cute guy from X4 and that you are that Barney guy. I know you hate being referred to as Bar..." "Cute?" I interrupted. "She said I'm cute?" Those were her exact words. "Oh. Damn," I said with disappointment. "What is wrong with that?" Skippy asked with surprise in his voice. "She said that I'm cute. Puppies are cute, Skippy. I was hoping she said that I'm hot." "Oh, boy," Skippy sighed heavily. "Every time I think I have plumbed the lowest depths of your stupidity, Joe, I find a bottomless well beneath it. At some point in your life,
You have had social contact with human women, right? Yet you apparently know absolutely nothing about the fairer sex.
Huh? How do you figure that?
Most of the time when the beer can insulted me, I didn't much care, but this time it bugged me. Joe, cute means she likes you, and that she feels comfortable around you. She also said you are funny. For a girl to go to bed with a guy, she needs to get past her inhibitions, let her guard down. If you are cute, and you make her comfortable, and especially if you can make her laugh, then dude, you are totally in. Trust me.
Wow. Great, I never thought of it like...
Unless she laughs when you take your pants off.
Yeah, I figured that.
She said that I'm cute and funny. So, I'm not telling you anything else, she said, Skippy protested.
Oh yeah, sure, because you're all about privacy, I said sarcastically.
No, it's because I like her, and I don't want you to do some typically stupid Joe thing and screw this up. You're likely to slip up and mention something I told you. I have been on dates with girls before, you know.
Shauna seducing you in the back of a truck was not a date, Joe.
Shauna, I felt a pang of sadness thinking about her stuck on paradise. Is not the first girl I have been with.
Oh, yeah, because you were such a stud in high school.
Well, you did go out with Melanie Rogers for almost 5 months during your senior year.
Hey, why did you two break up? Skippy asked.
We were young, and it's complicated.
Ooh, I think I know what the problem is. Can I guess?
He sounded like an overeager first-grade boy, desperate to get the teacher's attention.
What? I foolishly took the bait.
Was it her inability to deal with crushing disappointment every single day?
You are such an asshole. I couldn't help laughing. Why do I keep you around?
Most likely it is because of your shockingly poor judgment.
Yeah, that must be it. Getting ready for my date with Rachel, I took a shower and shaved. Then I contemplated what else to do. It had been a while since I'd been on a normal civilian date with a woman. Skippy offered to help.
Are you going to put on some of that body spray you bought at the base store?
I hesitated. I don't know, Skippy. It never seemed to work for me like it does for guys in the TV commercials.
Well, that's because you weren't using enough of it, Dum-Dum. You need to spray on at least twice as much to turn girls on.
Oh. Thanks, Skippy, I said as I reached for the can.
No, Skippy shouted. Damn, you are a dumbass. Seriously.
Oh, this is hopeless.
Hopeless. Girls hate it when a clueless guy uses too much cologne, and you guys always use too much or not at all. Put that can down. Get dressed. Wear the blue shirt.
The blue one? Why?
Because it picks up the blue in your eyes. Also because I went back through her Facebook posts and emails and IMs and credit card receipts, and I learned that Rachel purchased blue shirts for two of her previous boyfriends. Her favorite color is blue.
Hmm. That could be a problem, Skippy. Are you sure my shirt isn't going to remind her of an ex-boyfriend?
No, it's a different shade of blue. Trust me on this, Joe.
Dinner with Rachel was wonderful. I forget what I ate. Rachel had a salad like women do on first dates. She offered to pay for dinner since she had invited me out. I paid, explaining that I had a lot of back pay coming, there not being anything aboard a Theranan starship to spend money on anyway. After dinner, we went across the street to a bar with good music, and we had a terrific time. Rachel has a wicked sense of humor, especially after her second or maybe third lemon drop martini.
Fourth?
I lost track. I stuck to beer and tried to drink slowly. Damn, all I wanted was not to screw this up. I was on a real date, with a real woman, doing things like regular people did. That was all I wanted. We ended the night at her place. I don't remember how it happened. I do remember that I didn't try using any lame pickup line on her. Going to her place just seemed natural. Figuring that we both had a lot to drink, I took it slow, but apparently I was out of practice. She ruffled my hair with one hand.
Joe, stop. It's okay. I drank too many lemon drops. It's not going to happen for me tonight.
Hey, Joe! Skippy's distorted voice blared out of my Z-phone earpiece under the bed somewhere.
You should do that thing you did with Shauna. That worked.
Oh, I frantically fumbled around under the bed with one hand trying to find the stupid earpiece and kill it.
Who?
I could feel Rachel stiffen.
Is Shauna.
Her voice was icy as the interstellar depths.
The damned earpiece had rolled all the way under the far side of the bed. Nobody. I mean, my brain screamed at me that telling a woman I was with that a woman I had been with was nobody to me would not help my case. Not nobody. Nobody recent. Joe sweated up the sheets with Shauna on Camp Alpha, Skippy said cheerily. Not sheets, exactly. More like army-issue blankets in the back of a truck. Skippy, please, for the love of God, shut the hell up! Rachel slammed her legs together and smacked me in the chin with a knee. She knocked me off the bed onto the floor. The back of a truck? That was her idea, not mine. She wanted to... I stopped talking, because even I knew a woman doesn't want details of a man's prior sex partners. Sometimes my brain is way smarter than I am. I'm going to stop talking now. Wise choice, Rachel said, and pulled up the bed covers, shutting me out. Hey, it wasn't my idea to... This doesn't sound like you not talking, Joe. Oh, yeah. Right. Feeling like an idiot kneeling naked on the floor, I ducked down to reach under the bed, but I couldn't see the earpiece. How does this Skippy AI know what you did with her? You made a sex video? No, I said from under the bed. I saw the stupid thing now. It was almost out of reach. My Z-phone was under a blanket back then. That's the thing about Skippy. He can see and hear almost everything. Rachel pulled the covers up higher. Like, now he sees us from the ship? Skippy said something that I couldn't hear because I now had the earpiece and was squeezing the speaker in my fist. Yeah, he can see us. His technology is super advanced. Something about him being able to detect the way dust particles in the air vibrate, I think. He won't explain it to us humans. Uh-huh. Close enough. Skippy's voice now came out of the speaker in the clock radio. I am Skippy the Omniscient. I see all, I hear all, I know all. Rachel's face was sheer white. Everything? Pretty much, yeah, Skippy responded. Not that I pay attention much. You humans are generally not that interesting a species, and monkey mating kind of grosses me out. The last thing I want to watch is Joe's pasty white ass bouncing up and down. Yuck. The speaker began playing the soundtrack to a really bad porn movie with a heavy bass line and lots of moaning and sighing. Bow chicka bow boom boom bow bow chicka bow. Not that I watch bad porn movies, of course, but you know, I heard about them. Skippy, cut it out, I shouted. The music stopped. I'm only trying to help, Joe. Clearly what you were doing wasn't getting the job done. I'd suggest you look in her goodie drawer for assistance, but the batteries and her favorite toy are almost dead. Then he added in a low voice, Man, she gives that poor thing a workout. You want me to... Rachel's hand flew to her mouth. I thought she was going to pass out. Go away. I want you to go away, I shouted. Okay, fine. Remember that the next time you need my help. Rachel, look. I'm sorry. If I'd known your AI friend was making this a threesome, I would have said no. He watches everything you do? He watches everything everyone does. It's not just me. How do you live like that? She asked in horror. I shrugged. It's like if you're having sex and the dog is laying down in the corner of the room. It doesn't matter if it's watching you because it's just a dog. With Skippy, you get used to it because he truly doesn't care. He's just not that interested. If he's watching us here, he's watching a lot of other people at the same time. And that's only a tiny part of what's going on in his, mind at the time. She pulled the covers all the way up over her head. Only her fingernails were showing. I took that as my cue to leave. If I could find my pants. Where the hell were my pants? With a glance into the hallway, I determined they weren't there either. I'm sorry, Rachel. I'll get out of your hair. You have any idea where my pants are? She peeked out from under the covers. Your pants? No, I don't. Your friend Skippy is gone? I was too tired to care. Think so, yeah. Look, my pants must be under the cup. She flung the covers aside and looked at me with one eye open. I'm probably going to regret this, but can we sleep on this and talk in the morning? I'm too tired and I drank too much to think straight right now. That sounded good. Being in bed with her, simply being in bed. I was tired, and all I wanted to do was sleep. I slept like a log. She said she slept well also. In the morning, after I made coffee, we took a shower together and we hit the reset button. It was great. Sex is so much better when you're not drunk, and when you're awake. Later that morning, I walked down the street to a bakery to get breakfast. Strolling back with a bag of baked goodies, I was feeling on top of the world. The weather was beautiful, sunny with a few clouds here and there. It was a cool morning, but the afternoon promised to be pleasantly warm. There was a half-dressed woman waiting for me in her apartment, and since she had the day off, we had the whole day to ourselves. Friends of hers were having a cookout that evening, and we were invited. It felt great having no responsibilities. Let someone else save the world for a change. I was on leave. And, of course, the main reason for my super-ultra-great mood is that I got laid. Never underestimate that. Skippy called me. I held the Z-phone to my ear as if it were a regular cell phone. I didn't want to draw attention to myself. "Good morning, Joe," Skippy said with a cheery voice. "Were you and Rachel all right last night?" "You weren't watching us, were you?" "Not as far as you know." "Okay, good." I stopped to let a car pull into a driveway. "I really think that's a situation where you shouldn't..." "Hey, wait a minute. Not as far as I know." "Gosh, will you look at the time? I should be go..." "Not so fast, Skippy. You have some splain..." "Oh, what the hell? Why would it matter?" I'd gotten so used to his watching everything I did that I didn't care. "Hey, Skippy. You're the smartest being in the galaxy, right?" "Yep, as far as both of us know." "Great. Because I do not understand women. Human women. Can you give me some insight? Help a brother out?" Skippy sighed, or imitated a sigh. It was convincing. "Joe, I have studied all the literature about human-female psychology, read all the books written by and for women, downloaded every blog, every Instagram or Pinterest post, watched every program on the Lifetime Channel, listened in on conversations between women, and have chatted online with billions of your females. With all of my processing power over the equivalent of millions of years of analysis, I have come to one simple conclusion about human females." "And what's that?" I asked eagerly. "Bitches be crazy." "Skippy," I managed to say after I stopped laughing. "That's not nice." "Oh, was that inappropriate? I can never tell." "Decidedly inappropriate. Also wickedly funny, but don't do it again, huh?" "No problem. Seriously, Joe, women have just as much trouble understanding men as men have trouble understanding women. The difference is, women generally want to understand men in order to be better relationship partners. Men mostly are looking to get women into bed." "Well, get them into bed first." I felt the need to defend my gender. "Aha. Anyway, trying to understand women is a futile exercise. You may as well say you are trying to understand people, all people. My suggestion is you find one woman and do your best to understand her. I hear that is quite rewarding." "Someday, yeah. For now, me going off in the deep space on an alien pirate ship makes it difficult to get a relationship started, you know."
"Do you regret traveling around the galaxy with me?"
He sounded a little bit hurt.
"No, not at all, Skippy. Hey, come on. We saved the world together. Twice."
That remark got a strange look from a woman walking a dog past me. I lowered my voice.
"I wouldn't trade that experience for anything. And as much of a gargantuan asshole you are most of the time, I got to meet you. That's an incredible honor for a monkey like me."
"Same here. Well, probably more of an honor for you to meet me, to be honest. It's not even close, to tell the truth." "Asshole," I said under my breath. "I'm enjoying being on leave. It's great not to think about aliens destroying Earth for a few days. You need a break. You deserve it." "Okay, Joe, I'll leave you alone for a while, unless you contact me." "Hey, heads up, Joe. Rachel is on her phone talking with one of her friends about you." "Oh, crap. Am I in trouble?"
"Quite the contrary, Joe. She is saying only good things about you."
"Damn. Girls tell each other everything."
"Everything?"
I did not like the sound of that.
"You men would be shocked. Again, she is saying good things about you. This is not my area of expertise, but you may get lucky again today."
Chapter 3. Paradise.
To seek glory and battle is glorious emerged high above the planet's southern continent, almost two-thirds of the way to the pole. Jumping in there had caught the Ruhar defenders badly out of position. They had been deployed to protect the northern continent where all the important Ruhar facilities were. That was also where the Ruhar population was concentrated. Only a handful of Ruhar were stationed on the southern continent to monitor the humans there. The Ruhar Task Force commander acted quickly, ordering three of his ships to climb up to jump distance so they could surround the enemy vessel. This took less than a minute, during which time the other Ruhar ships fired masers and missiles at the enemy. The masers would very likely miss, and the missiles would likely be intercepted by the enemy frigate's defensive masers, but the Ruhar action would keep the enemy busy. The Ruhar commander was puzzled when, instead of proceeding north at high speed to attack Ruhar facilities on the surface, the enemy ship suddenly fired a maser beam at the southern continent. The maser beam's focus had been tuned to broaden its area of impact. Rather than an intense, pencil-thin beam, it covered a wider area. The enemy was, for some unknown reason, targeting the humans' food supply. The maser beam was scorching fields of healthy crops and killing humans who had been caught in the open. Why were the Kristang expending resources to hit the humans, a species who had no combat power to threaten the Kristang? No matter, the Ruhar commander decided, that was a question that could be addressed later. The three ships he had assigned to deal with the enemy frigate reached jump distance and disappeared, only to re-emerge above the southern continent in three bursts of gamma radiation. The lightly armored Kristang frigate would soon be forced to withdraw. Then the Ruhar would assess the damage it had inflicted. No. A Kristang destroyer suddenly jumped in above the northern continent and immediately fired at several targets. To his shame, the Ruhar commander saw that the actions of the frigate had been intended to lure part of his force away from their normal patrol area, and he had rashly fallen for the enemy trick. Alarmed, he scrambled to redeploy his other ships and recalled two of the ships he had sent to deal with the frigate. Before the two enemy ships had been chased away, the destroyer was able to successfully hit four targets on the surface. 38 Ruhar died in the attack, and a weapons depot was also damaged. Next time, the Ruhar commander told himself, with grim determination, he would not be fooled into dividing his forces. That there would be a next time was one thing of which he was certain. Earth. The cookout with Rachel's friends was great, except they had chicken and hot dogs, no cheeseburgers, and everyone wanted to ask me about my experience with X4, what it was like on Paradise, with the Kristang be coming back, and a thousand other questions. In every answer, I was careful to stick to the script of UNEF's cover story, and was as vague as possible with my answers. Rachel saw the pained look on my face after a while, and we bailed early. The next morning, it was going to be another nice day, and she suggested we go on a trail ride with horses. Rachel said she had always been into horses. Her family had a horse when she was in high school, and she rode in some competitions, jumping, stuff like that. A long ride on the back of a horse, it wasn't my idea of a great time. We can go ride dirt bikes instead. It had been a while since I'd ridden a motorcycle. I expected it wouldn't take me long to get used to it again. When I was living at home, riding trails on a dirt bike or a snowmobile was regularly great fun on weekends. She tilted her head at me. Joe, you're not afraid of horses, are you? No, it's just that I... Damn, the last time I'd been on a horse had to be when I was 10 years old. That was only sitting on a horse while it slowly walked around a ring at the county fair. All I remember of that experience was thinking how far off the ground I was, and that if the horse wanted to go somewhere, I wouldn't be able to control it.
Really? You went into space to fight aliens, but you're worried about a horse? I'm not thrilled with the idea of trusting a big, dumb animal between my legs.
Of course, I grinned. You girls just call that prom night.
Joe!
She laughed and slapped me playfully.
You are awful sometimes.
I'm terribly, terribly sorry, I said with zero sincerity. Sure, we can go on a trail ride. I'd like to try that, I smiled reassuringly. Being out in the great outdoors having fun with a pretty girl, who wouldn't enjoy that?
Do you know how to ride a horse?
I shrugged. I grabbed the horse's ears, I pantomimed with my hands. Left hand is the brake, right is the throttle.
Sure, Joe, she laughed again. I would love to get a picture of that. These horses know what to do, and they follow the horse in front of them.
Uh-huh.
So all I need to do is sit down, shut up, and hang on? That's the idea. If you get in trouble, I can rescue you.
Oh, great.
The horse ride was a lot of fun, and we took a drive in the country afterward. Gas supplies had recovered enough that most people could resume driving their cars at least occasionally again. Although at $6.50 a gallon, you had to think about whether a trip was worth it. Being a gentleman, I paid to fill up Rachel's car. It was almost painful taking that much cash out of my wallet. The next day was Monday. Rachel had to work, and I had to answer a bunch more questions. That afternoon, she had to fly to Arnold Air Force Base in Tennessee for a conference that would last until Friday morning. It was some computer flight simulator software type thing she was working on. Wanting to impress her, I almost opened my big mouth to say that I was a pilot, qualified to fly a Theranin dropship. Fortunately, good sense stopped me before I blew part of our cover story. Damn, this lion thing was getting old already. She was scheduled to fly back to Dayton on Friday afternoon, but on Saturday morning, she would be leaving for a girls' weekend that she and her friends had been planning for months. My timing sucked, that was for sure. "I'm sorry, Joe," she said. "Hey, I understand. I'll be here when you get back. I'm not going anywhere." I was wrong about that. To my complete surprise, the debriefing wrapped up Tuesday afternoon, and the Army granted me 2 weeks of leave. Maybe they figured I deserved leave after our long mission. And it wasn't just me. Major Sims and Sergeant Adams texted me that their own debriefings were over for now, and they were on leave also. Same with the Ranger and SEAL teams, who had been part of the Merry Band of Pirates. My opinion was that we had given UNEF a whole lot to think about, and they needed to process it before bringing us back in for more questions. At some point soon, the Dutchman needed to go back out. Needed to go back out in order to verify the Theranin weren't sending another ship to Earth. I called Rachel and told her I was going to visit my folks for a while, even though I really, really wanted to see her again. And my timing really, really sucked.
"You're packing, Joe?" Skippy asked while I was stuffing clothes into a duffel bag. "Going to see your loved ones?"
"Yeah, Skippy. My parents have been waiting for me to come home since I called them after we jumped into orbit."
"But your loved ones are right here, Joe."
"Huh? My loved ones?" If he was referring to himself, he was still in his escape pod man cave aboard the Flying Dutchman.
"Your loved ones, Joe. You know, Jim Beam, Jack Daniels, Johnny Walker.
Oh, very funny." Maybe I did have time for a nice drink before I left.
Paradise.
Baterna looked up in shock from the document she was reading.
"I cannot believe this. This came from our government."
"Yes, ma'am," said her aide, Pullen Grace. Grace had been with Baterna Logelia for over a decade, a tumultuous decade. The next year did not appear like it would be any less eventful.
"It is not an official recommendation from the federal government, nor is it expressed as desired policy."
"Yet. It is not yet official government policy. Pollen, this is horrific. I feel unclean even reading this."
"Yes, ma'am," Pollen agreed. And he did agree. Sometimes his job was to listen and allow the deputy administrator to vent her feelings to a private audience.
"These are people they're talking about, sentient beings. They are a young, backwards, and ignorant species. It's not their fault that they are here."
"Yes, ma'am." Pollen had done this many times before. After venting her feelings, Ms. Logelia would be ready to discuss policy with a cool, clear head. That was much better than many political leaders that Pollen Grace knew. They let their emotions run their decision-making process. It was understandable that his boss was upset. The report she was reading was radical and shocking. The report stated that the Ruhar federal government, many light years away, was considering whether it would be wise policy for the humans on Gitanu to be sterilized permanently. The report inquired into the practical, biological, and political implications of such a policy. It did not inquire into whether such a policy would be morally acceptable.
"If I may guess, ma'am, I think the impetus behind this report was the last status document that was requested by the federal government."
Baterna silently raised an eyebrow.
"In the status data," Pullen reminded her, "there were statistics about the human situation. Food supply, how much food they had in storage,
how much food they were growing currently, projections of future crop yields. All fairly dry information. The federal government had been concerned about the financial drain of providing nutrient mush to humans, humans who were technically a client species of the Ruhar's bitter enemies. Within that data were statistics on the human population, and Poland pulled those numbers up on his tablet and showed her. It states there are currently 40 humans pregnant, plus 17 children who have been born since humans landed on Paradise. But Turner was not surprised. Not having the advantage of genetic engineering, human females could not consciously choose when to ovulate.
The government is concerned about such small numbers?
Administrator, I think our government is mostly concerned about the precedent that has been set. When the humans came here, we know one strict condition imposed on them by the Kristang was that all troops were required to use long-term birth control technologies. That policy was strictly adhered to by their expeditionary force until the Kristang lost control of this planet. We do know that the authority of their force command has been called into question by their rank-and-file troops.
Understandably,
Paterna said with sympathy.
They are not only trapped here indefinitely, they have lost all communications with their homeworld. Their homeworld is the ultimate source of the authority for their military leaders here.
Yes, ma'am. We know from monitoring their internal communications, the Ruhar provided the Z-phone network that humans all used, that there had been widespread discussion of whether their society here should have a military structure at all in the future. But Turner sighed.
Very well. The chief administrator will have to reply to this.
She pointed to the report on her screen distastefully.
He will expect me to craft a position for him.
She understood that her boss considered the humans to be a problem for Deputy Administrator Baterna Logelia, because the chief administrator had more important concerns.
Yes, ma'am, Poland said, knowing that meant he would be expected to prepare various policy options for her.
Fortunately, the two knew each other so well by now that he could guess exactly how she would like to reply to the federal government's offensive inquiry.
I will get my people right on it.
One thing they were not going to do was inform the humans, unless, that is, the proposed policy was put in effect. And by then it would be too late. Earth.
I called my folks to let them know I would be coming home. I had called them and my sister every day since the Dutchman jumped into orbit, and they understood that I had military duties to take care of before I could see them. Because I wasn't sure how or when I would get there, we agreed that I would get somewhere near Maine and call them again. Being at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton, Ohio, my plan was to try flying Space A to Westover in Massachusetts. After waiting a full day, it became clear that space available on Air Force transports was zero and not likely to improve soon. Someone suggested I could fly commercial. The economy had rebounded to the point where airlines were flying regular schedules again. When I checked on the prices, I couldn't stomach paying that much. Sure, I had a lot of back pay coming. Money earned at a colonel's pay grade and with a hazardous duty bonus. That money was with my parents. But after getting my ass chewed out by UNEF and the U.S. Army, I thought maybe I should make that money last as long as I could in case my military career was over. So I took a bus up to Cleveland and caught a train to Boston. The train was, amazingly, clean and on time. Back when the economy had been in the toilet and there wasn't any fuel for civilian planes, passenger railroads had stepped up and moved people around. It was still a long trip, in a coach seat because there weren't any sleeping berths available. Skippy offered to hack into the railroad reservation system and get a sleeper cabin for me. I declined the offer. In Boston, I did the duffel bag drag across the station and caught a train to Bangor, Maine. This train was a lot slower and stopped more often. The trip gave me time to think. I found myself thinking about Paradise, wondering what people I knew there were doing, wondering if they were still there at all. That wasn't a pleasant thought. My parents, bless them, arranged for a welcome home party for me in the gym of the elementary school. The original plan was for a cookout, but it was raining, so we had a cook-in instead. Having a big party was a great plan, because it allowed me to meet half the people in the town at the same time and answer all their questions at the same time.
Telling my story once made it a lot easier to stick to the official cover story. It also helped that UNEF's cover story had been all over the news since the Dutchman returned, so people already knew most of the carefully crafted lies that I told them. Damn, it was good to be home again. My father grilled a cheeseburger for me. It was cheeseburger perfection. Okay, the truth is I ate 3 cheeseburgers that day, which tragically left no appetite for the baked beans, a potato salad, or 3-bean salad, or anything vegetable-related. Did ketchup count as a vegetable? That kind of food I could eat any day. Even though there had been fixins for cheeseburgers aboard the Dutchman, I had only indulged in that culinary delight maybe a half dozen times during the mission. They just weren't the same without being cooked on a charcoal grill. And being on Newark had seriously cut into my opportunity to eat cheeseburgers, because our logistics expert Major Sims had been ruthless about bringing only essential items down to Newark. She did not consider even the most delicious of cheeseburgers to be essential. Not that I'm still bitter about that. Anyway, being back home was great. The only bad part of coming home was that TV reporters had learned that I would be there, and stations from Bangor, Portland, and as far away as Boston were there to pester me with questions. They weren't happy with me because I stuck to the UNEF script. Be boring, I had been advised by the UNEF public relations people. The cover story was that aboard the ship I had been part of the support crew for the Special Forces team. The purpose of the mission had been for the Theranin to train our Spec Ops people in space warfare.